Right now, we catch up with Brian Burke down the guest hotline. Good morning, Brian. How are things?
Good. How are you guys?
We're doing well. Yeah, we are doing just fine. Stanley Cup final starting to wind its way. What last leg could be a quick close here. Stamkos comes back. It was a neat scene to see how happy his teammates were for him. Obviously, he scores, and that's great. He was emotional post-game about it, and it meant a lot to him. But it's always neat in a team game, and you can see what he means to all those guys, the coaches, the staff, everybody's so excited for him on the bench. It was a neat moment in a lopsided game.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that was genuine, and they were genuinely, sincerely enthusiastic about him. And, you know, I think that is likely going to be it for him in the series, but having played a pivotal role, it's just too bad that didn't stand up as the game-winning goal, but I was happy for him. He's a good guy and a great player, and he's had real tough luck with injuries, so you can see how happy his teammates were for him.
So do you think, was it an aggravation of the injury in the game that you think will keep him out, or do you think maybe this was part of the plan? Get in, play a little bit, we could use a win here. We'd hate to leave you before it's too late in the series and we're down before we bring you in.
No, I think, I mean, that's, we talked about this on the show. That's one of the hardest things in the world is when you bring an injured guy back. And I think if you go on John Cooper's comments and my belief, which is you've got to be able, if you tell me you can play, you got to be able to finish the game. There's got to be a pretty certain chance that you finish the game and that you can't re-injure whatever the injury is further. Because they played short for two periods. Now, he gave him a big lift. No question his presence on the bench was uplifting. But this goes back to, I used to say to the doctors, look, if you're not pretty confident, you can give me 60 minutes, even with limited ice time, just power play and maybe another 5 minutes here and there, then don't dress him. I'll dress an able-bodied player, and I'll get a full game out of him. So I don't think that would ever be a plan to say, hey, yeah, do what you can, and if we have to take you out in the first, we'll take you out in the first. They played two periods, essentially, and some without a body that could help them win.
Yeah, 46 minutes, 18 seconds. He basically sat there after his first five shifts. And as nice a story as it is today, right, it's everyone's kind of celebrating. It's a cool hockey story. If it goes the other way and he can't play and they lose by a goal or they lose in overtime with an exhausted bench, the story's a lot different today, right?
Yeah, for sure. And that's the beauty of sports, right? I really felt that Dallas had taken over the game before the two Radulov penalties, and then that just flattened them.
Yeah. So how do you see it playing out now? You've been there, 2-1 leads after a 1-1 tie or whatever. What's been your feel on a 2-1 lead with how you see Tampa looking far less lethargic than they did earlier in the series?
Well, I think the better team is Tampa Bay. No question in my mind on paper, but as I said on TV, I'm not betting against Dallas again. I've picked against them in every series, and they were 12 seconds away from going home against Calgary. So what they've done is remarkable. They've played better in every round. They've turned into the most physical team in the playoffs, which is not, you know, they've always been physical, but they weren't ever imposing, and now they are imposing. But their lack of discipline concerns me, and the amount of work on Hudobin concerns me. And they've got a back-to-back coming up. So we'll see. I always felt that even games in a playoff series are the critical ones. So you got game four is tomorrow night. And if Dallas can't win that game, they're in serious trouble. If they win it, they're back to a best of three. And so they've gotten great goaltending. Their special teams have been pretty good, although the Tampa Bay power play has woken up.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say game four to me is likely going to be the series.
I want to switch gears a little bit. I just want to ask you about what you're seeing with Alex Pietrangelo. Less the player, and I guess just because you were a GM, and just kind of your read on what we're seeing. The player has come out and has said his piece. He's obviously not happy. The GM isn't saying a whole lot, but he's trying to hold firm, Doug Armstrong, to no move clauses. He's not doing that sort of thing, and that's hard to do in 2020. I know agents will say he's crazy if he thinks he can do it. The rumored offer from St. Louis is in the neighborhood of 8 years times $8 million. That's not chump change. What's your read on where Pietrangelo and the Blues are at right now?
Well, I haven't heard the 8x8. I'm not. It's apparent to me after the Brodin signing that owners are still going to sign top guys and, to try to keep them. But I don't know going forward where the cap's going to be flat for 5 years, in my opinion, and you're not going to see revenues recover. The 16% cap on escrow, I think that's going to go by the boards for next season. Next year will be 20. The following year, 21, 22, it's supposed to be 16. I think that's going to go by the boards. I don't think we've comprehended the economic damage, the extreme economic damage this pandemic has caused teams and owners. And so a lot of owners back in the day, the hockey team lost $6 million and their other businesses made them $400, they're like, wow, it's a rounding error. As the late, great Ken King would say, mm-hmm. it's a good bottle of wine. And to me, it's, we're looking at a different landscape. So I'd be shocked if there's an 8x8 on the table. No move, no trade clauses, I think, are going to be rare. And there's still plenty of time to get this deal done in St. Louis. So I'll be very curious how much discipline there is among the GMs re-signing their own players, and then again on October 9th. The Berlin contract says to me they're still going to pay.
Ryan Pinder, you had a question?
No, Rhett wanted to jump in there. Go ahead.
Okay. I just wanted to ask, were these always a big deal for players, Brian? I mean, you, in Hartford, when you started out, were guys asking for no trades? And even when you are asking for the no trade, usually when the situation or the relationship sours, nobody wants to be part of it anyway, do they?
No, but I think what happens is, and good question, Rhett, back in Hartford, no one wanted a no trade because we were awful. The guys would have been happy to get on a plane.
I got a trade clause.
Well, I think it's the difference is, okay, I'll give you an example of Thomas Coverley. So it got to the point where I wanted to move him. He was unrestricted that summer and he had a full no trade, no move. And you're right, at that point, when the team is soured on you, for sure you want to go somewhere else. But when you have a no trade, no move, you can control where you go. You can pick. You can say to the team, here's, I have a full no trade, no move. I'll give you three teams. So Thomas Coverley gave us one team, Boston. And I said, well, if that doesn't work, I'm going to ask for more teams. But we were able to work out a deal that we liked with Boston for a first-round pick and Joel Colborne. So it gives you some control. So I understand why players still want it. And someone can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think I ever gave a full trade, a full no trade, no move clause to a player for the length of his contract. It was modified no trade at best.
We were talking about Tampa and defensemen. I was just looking at the standings. If I'm correct, you're in Anaheim in 2009. That's the year that. No? Okay.
No.
I'm looking at the Hedman draft
the
where he goes two.
I left in fall of 08.
Okay, so I'm off by a year. What do you remember about the Hedman draft, and were you at that point focused on a draft or not? That's where I was trying to connect the dots on your career, because we're just watching this guy now over a decade later, and he's dominant. He's probably going to win the Conn Smythe.
Yeah, there was a big debate, and I was with Toronto at the time. There was a big debate on the floor, Tavares or Hedman. Like, this is not a case of Hedman snuck under the radar. There was a legitimate debate. There were a number of teams who said they'd take Hedman first overall and a whole bunch of teams who would take Tavares overall. And I think the Islanders wavered over that for some time. And they're both great players. They both had great careers, both really good picks. Obviously, Victor Hedman right now is the best defenseman on the planet.
And you guys had Kadri at six. You're right. That was the famous year you chatted with, what, Brian Murray on the floor about who was going to go, him or Cowan?
Yeah, and I felt, to this day, that haunts me, that conversation, because I was mic'd up, and I was getting up to go pick Kadri, and Brian Murray came up and tapped me on the shoulder and said, do you want to switch picks? And I said, well, who are you taking? And he said, Kadri. I said, well, that's who we're taking, and I turned away. When I watched it later, I looked like I was dismissive toward a man that I really liked and respected, and it bothers me to this day. There are only a few things that I've done that really bother me, and that one did. Because it looked bad. I wasn't dismissive in my mind, but it looked bad. There was a camera on us, and I was like, that's who we're taking. I just turned and walked away. And it bothers me to this day that I was disrespectful or looked to be disrespectful with a guy I admired that much. But, yeah, we took We took Kadri. We were really excited about that pick.
Well, and what's interesting, I didn't even interpret it that way. I just was, you know, we hear about trades. We never know how they go down, and it just seems so matter of fact, and that like this wasn't 15 phone calls. It could really be as simple as a couple sentences. So I always found that access really, that was cool. That was neat to see, but interesting you weren't a fan of that.
Well, I wore a mic for the draft for probably five or six different drafts. Once I did the Sedin deal and the Pronger deal back in Hartford in 93, people thought, well, he's the matchmaker. He's the guy you want a microphone on. So I was asked routinely to wear a mic during the draft, and most years I would do it. I think that adds color for the viewers. You know, you get to hear a guy talking on the floor. You're part of the action. I think it's a great addition to the draft to have someone mic'd up, one of the GMs. So I agreed to do it, but what they didn't realize is after the Sedin deal, I was like kryptonite on the floor. Like I couldn't make a deal to save my life after that deal.
So how much are you worried about, like, let's say you've been working on a big blockbuster that maybe doesn't come together and now people in a TV truck have heard it. Did you ever worry about the rumor mill when you were mic'd up there or not?
No, I just covered the mic. I just put my hand over it when we were talking about something.
Okay, it's pretty simple.
They don't get total access. Just
yeah.
Some.
Okay.
Well, I remember that was the draft, the 09 draft in Montreal, and I have among the memories, there are some that are stories for on-air and some that are for off-air, as you would know. But I've kept this clip over the years. You were being asked afterwards about Nazem Kadri, and that Kadri was a bit of a character.
Yeah, he's a mean little bastard. I don't mind that.
Little mean little bastard.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, he is. Still is to this day. And I'll tell you
well,
what.
That's what you can see with Naz. The reason we were so excited about Naz is he scored like 1,000 points for London. Like, I don't know, 100 and something points, 90 points. But he got involved. He killed penalties. He'd stick people. He'd hit. He'd defend teammates. And he wasn't big back then. Now he's turned into a pretty thick little guy, right? He's a pretty muscular guy. But he was a tiny kid then, and he still played like it's like when Chris Russell played for me in Calgary. Chris Russell's his problem is no one ever told him he was small. He doesn't think he's small.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a Jack Russell Terrier. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll tear into a Rottweiler. They don't care, and that's what Naz had, and so that's why we're so excited to get him. When you get a combination of that skill level, and that compete level, and that toughness, that's really rare.
The other moment that I have from the Montreal draft, and it was like you say, it's fun for fans and all of that, and it was terrific because you were in Toronto, and it was a commercial break during the broadcast, and you were on the podium getting set to make the Kadri pick. And, of course, it's in Montreal. So the fans are chanting 67, and it's such a great atmosphere in Montreal, and they're ripping the Leafs. And then it was, again, in the break. And they put a shot of you, a close-up of you on the Jumbotron, and the whole building started to boo, just raining down boos. Boo! It was so loud. The building exploded. And you were looking at your phone. You kind of looked up to see what was going on, and then you looked up at the Jumbotron and realized that they were reacting to you. And you kind of put a half smile and a chuckle on, and then the whole place started to cheer and laugh. It was perfect. It was that Leafs Habs rivalry. It was such a neat moment to watch the Montreal fans. It was really kind of a neat moment, I thought.
Yeah, and I think I said at the mic, it's always nice to get a nice welcome here in Montreal or something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah,
I'll tell you a story about the Leafs Montreal rivalry. When we played in Montreal, we stayed at the Vogue Hotel. It's only four blocks from the rink, and the number one criteria for a hotel for the Toronto Maple Leafs is small lobby. So that we can restrict the number of fans and autograph seekers that come in. Like, it's that big. The Leafs are that big. So it was a four-block walk to the rink. And I would always walk to the rink. And I got abused the entire way. Like, people would stop their cars and get out and swear at me and curse at me. And I remember the players were like, why don't you just ride the bus? I'm like, this is the best entertainment you can get for free.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm walking to the rink. A guy drove past me, recognized me, stopped his car, stopped traffic, got out, and started cursing at me like a longshoreman. F this, F that, you no good, multisyllabic words. And I said to him, you know, I said, are you having fun? Because I am.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really a neat spot. I've not, oddly enough, I've not been there for a game. I'd love to go for a playoff game. They get ripped pretty good for how crazy fans can get, and the media, obviously you got two languages, so you got double the media, but it's a fun spot to be, I would guess, when you're winning and when you're playing and just as an observer.
Yeah, and as I've always said in Montreal, is if you're a GM in Montreal, you're stupid twice.
That's
in
right.
In Toronto, you're only stupid once.
Yeah. Well, Brian, thanks for this, man. Enjoy the weekend. We'll catch up in a week, and we'll have a cup winner by then to talk about.
We will. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. There's Brian Burke.